Hello and welcome to the second part of our discussion about risk and climate change with me, Jonathan Mason from the Victorian Managed Insurance Authority and Lynette Smith from the Grammar Consultancy. The first part of our discussion focused on the implications of the ISO's definition of risk, the effect of uncertainty on objectives. And we explored what uncertainty and objectives mean for people working in the public sector. In the second part of this discussion, we'll look at how you can come up with well-articulated objectives that, if achieved, can get us closer to being a sustainable, well-adapted society. We'll also discuss some techniques for reducing uncertainty about the future. Because if you're going to try to manage the effect of uncertainty on your objectives, then that's a good place to start. You'll find links to all the resources and ideas we discuss in the show notes. And we begin with talking about why risk management in the public sector is really all about protecting public value.
When we were talking previously about risk management, and I don't like to get too into the weeds talking about international standards and that sort of thing, but I think it is good reflecting on risk management as an ethos, as a way of doing things, and a bit of the why. The standard says that risk management, the purpose of doing this thing, thinking about the future and slowing down and thinking about the future, and then doing a series of as cognitive tasks that make you and put you in a better position, is that it creates and protects value. So we sort of, perhaps we could maybe pursue that idea a bit further.
Yeah, I think it's really good to bring this up. We spoke mostly about objectives in the first podcast. And I think it's important just to check for a moment whether if one achieves that objective, whether you've actually done something valuable. Have you created something that's worth having done the work of doing it, achieving that objective? Have you protected something that you care about? And your objective, whatever that is, has to be something that, clearly for anyone who looks at that objective, they look at it and they see, if we achieve that, we will have done something worthwhile. I do hear people say that value is hard to talk about. And so I just sort of want to amplify a bit on that because, maybe it is. I'm not sure. But I wonder if some of the difficulty comes from the fact that we have to be explicit about things that we take for granted, have to find the words for what we don't normally find words for. There's also such a preoccupation with quantifying the value of things as well. And we've got fairly restricted instruments for thinking about the value of things in quantitative terms. Markets have always been the way that we do that. So, there's a couple of things there. One is being explicit about the things that we normally take for granted. The other thing is the problem about quantification, which is a good thing. I'm not anti-quantification. I'm not anti-economics and so on. But I think if, there's one thing that we've learned, if there's one thing that climate change tells us, it's that we haven't been taking into account some of the things we need to when it comes to our economic and social development. We had, in our first episode, we invited Carl Obst to talk to us about why we need to value the environment, for instance. I think I'm just bringing him into this picture because he spoke about, I think he referred to the System for Economic and Environmental Accounts, which is a UN system. What's really good about it is it's systematic and you can apply it consistently. And it's also a way that you can produce some numbers, but also not lose sight of some of the things that have been forgotten in the past when it comes to economic accounting.
It might seem like a prosaic thing. It's really not, the idea of measuring things and the idea that if you look at something, you affect it. It's almost quantum mechanics, isn't it? But if you start looking at things through a particular perspective, people behave differently and the measures you choose affect how people behave. And I think it's really important to think about that balanced with the need to keep a system understandable. I know I've spent time with a CEO once who said to me, this organization has 60 corporate measures. That means that, do some quick maths, I have 3 days per corporate measure a year. And you're saying to me, these are the most important measures. And it really made me think, it's like, oh yeah, you're right. It's like, so what are the most important things we want to measure? Because there's only a limited amount of bandwidth. And I think what we're saying is that we're not always measuring the right thing.
Yeah, I really like that remark, actually. You sent me a blog post, which I really loved, actually, that just urged us to pull back a bit on the mantra of you can't manage what you, but if you don't measure it, you can't manage it, that phrase, yeah, which is over said, that one, and it does deflect you, I think, potentially from genuine questions about what it is to manage something. One of the things I really liked about Carl's interview from a few weeks ago, it's published on the IPA website, by the way, and we'll put it in the show notes. He said that it's the conceptual framework that matters, and it doesn't mean that you have to convert everything into numbers. You know, the idea is really to start from the right conceptual framework and use that consistently.
I think with the conceptual framework, it's worth thinking about how does it, you know, what's right for different actors. I think you talked about, you know, different people from different regions.
You know, I think that the System for Economic and Environmental Accounts is terrific because it brings system in, and from that you get consistency and scale, and these are the things that matter for governments. They have to take whole states into consideration. They have to show that they are fair and reasonable in their distribution of resources and so on. And there is something, though, that we need to bear in mind when it comes to value, what value is. It's always, something is always valuable to someone in the particular circumstances of their life, or also in terms of the goals that they have for themselves. And maybe this is another dimension of things that tend to be implicit, taken for granted. You know, I've been thinking in particular about the problem of the opportunities, the risks and opportunities that go with becoming a well-adapted society, a well-adapted economy that involves change, a lot of change. And I think that one of the most important things that we need policymakers as we enter this period of change is for them to have genuine equal conversations with people in the places where they are, so Mildura compared to Onthaggi or Melbourne and so on. So, you know, we're going to have to adapt, and it'll mean something different depending on where you are. We're going to have to adapt, and we need to ask you, you know, what must, through this change, what must continue to go right for you? What can't go wrong? You know, and what are you willing to give up in order to keep those things that matter to you? That's really one way to unpack the value conversation, to discover what is valuable, the value that you need to create and protect for people.
It reminds me of some learnings, I guess, that I've had as a working as a risk manager and also working in human-centered design. I guess in those of you that are familiar with risk management as an idea, there's a process, linear sort of approach, the step-by-step sort of approach. And the very first step that we talk about is context setting, is addressing the context. And I think what I've learned and what we're talking about here is we need to spend more time in context, understanding what we mean by value. At similar to, if I put my design thinking hat on, when we think about problems, often we go to solve a problem without we go straight from a problem, one problem that we've identified, to a solution. So we jump straight to the solution. And human-centered design is about the idea of saying there's a range of possible problems that exist out there. Let's go through a series of techniques to understand what the nature of those problems are before we lock into a solution. And then going further, there's a range of different solutions that we should try more quickly than maybe we did in the old days, where we would build one big solution and hope for the best. So what you're talking about conceptually seems to fit into what I've seen in my career, where there is, you know, too much, we go too quickly to solution, And as risk managers, we skip over context setting. And I guess going from that, what you talked about in terms of value and in the context of adaptation and living in different regions and so forth, there's like another step there, isn't there, to distill this into an objective?
Really, the next step, you know, for something to be an objective, you brought this up in the last podcast, actually, that acronym SMART, specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound. You know, I think that wider examination of the context, that richer theory of value and a systematic way of quantifying some dimensions of value, that will generate a lot of information for your objectives. It'll help make sure they're specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound, all of that. You know, one thing I find, for instance, is people sometimes forget about the time thing. And that thing of, is your objective actually specific, unique to you, or is it generic? Is this something that anyone else could have? You know, if you've got a SMART objective, then it really will be unique to you. It really will be clear how it makes a difference in the context that you're talking about there.
I don't tend to think of SMART as being a, you have to, you know, every single time you set a goal, it has to fit SMART. It's more a case of, if you don't want to end up with, as you say, objectives that sound like they're written by a robot, and if you don't want to end up with an objective which is could mean too many different things to too many important stakeholders, then a good tool is to run it through SMART and say, you know, is it specific enough? Is it measured? And it talks to the measures, right? So it also, the idea of SMART goes to that first part of our conversation today around choosing the right measures. You'll choose the right measures if you define them properly within your objective. So that's, I guess that's what I would say around that. And I guess now thinking about climate change, and let's bring it back to thinking about the issues and risks associated with climate change here in Victoria. As we know, the rules here, and if you practice within the public sector in Victoria, you have to consider climate change as part of the Climate Change Act in all decision making. So perhaps can swing to that.
Yeah. Consider. I see that word so many times in public service talk, and I it's just one of my least favourite words in the lexicon, because you don't need to do much really to fulfil that. Yeah, to make it relevant to the issue of how we manage the risks and opportunities associated with climate change, I reckon, just to take it out of Victoria, I remember going to, there was an adaptation conference last year in Sydney, which I went to, really good. Anyway, there was someone from the New South Wales government that did a presentation for us on some scenario work that they had done for the whole state, which I thought it was excellent, actually. Those scenarios, there were four, as is usual with scenarios, you give four distinct scenarios. These ones gave a nice rounded out picture quite a few dimensions. So it wasn't just about what's going to happen with the climate. It also looked at the environment, social dimensions, technological, political as well. So looking at all these different aspects of the future state of affairs at a particular point in time, I think they were talking about 2050 with that one. The slides are actually available. So again, in the show notes. One thing that's important to say about scenarios, I think, is that they don't give you the objectives, just to loop back to that issue. It gives you an insight. It's the context thing, actually, Jono. It gives you insight into what things will plausibly be like in the future. So a plausible future context, which you need to think about when you're defining your objectives. And again, with scenarios, I think that they're really good at those state scale decisions, like what sort of transport or justice system that you need in, say, 2050 or something. So that's scenarios are terrific. I think they're a great tool for thinking in concrete ways about the future. One of the ways they get used, which I really love, also from New South Wales, we saw Shoalhaven Shire Council, I think that's where they were from, someone called Sarah Tassich presented to us about how they applied those state level scenarios to the shoal haven. And that was really excellent work. And the other thing about it too is they were doing consultation with people in the shoal haven in order to produce those downscaled scenarios. And, you know, so what is a downscaled scenario? It's not a replication of the information. So across the state, temperatures will be 1.5, you know, whatever, warmer in 50 years. And it's saying what that would likely be in the shoal haven. It's more saying what would it mean? It's actually a meaning thing. So if the temperatures rise in that way, if sea levels change in that way, if rainfall patterns change in the way that we think they will, and all those other dimensions like population increases or technological changes and so on, if things change that way in a general way, what will it mean here in Shoalhaven? So it's a meaning-making exercise there using real information that the state puts together.
That's the sort of things that we often talk to clients about at VMIA, the idea that we actually use concrete scenarios to bring alive the future. So as realistic as possible, and having permission as leaders in organizations to be able to do that work. I did a piece of work a few years ago with a water corporation in Victoria. And I remember, you know, emblazoned on the walls was innovation. And I marched into this room with a box of Lego and some toys and some post-it notes to do some work. And fortunately for me, I had that wall, you know, emblazoned on the wall, the word innovation. So, you know, it was easy to convince the group who were, you know, fine suited group of professionals who didn't look like they were used to playing with children's toys to do imaginative work. And, you know, some of the most staid people in the room were quite, you know, interested in the idea of the future once we allow them to play with physical objects. So using techniques with a group of adults and having the permission to do that helps them to imagine the future in a way that's meaningful. Like you say, it brings back meaning. And I really like a couple of keywords you're using. One is around scalability, because often when we talk about these concepts, they sound highfalutin, like they could only be deployed by BHP or Commonwealth Bank or one of the large government departments. The idea that a kindergarten, a small community health organisation can use exactly the same techniques and the same thinking, and it's just as relevant to think about the future in the same way. I think that's a really important message of this. The other word that you hit on before is plausible. So in the world that I came from, the risk management world, you know, there's all this stuff around likelihood and consequence, and is something really highly likely or low likelihood? Often that's very hard to determine, but it's usually very easy to get a group of people with a bunch of ideas, values, objectives, goals to come together with something where you go, yeah, that's plausible. We don't know whether it's really high or low likelihood at all, but we could tell you it's plausible. And I think it's a really powerful word to use. And it, again, gives permission to people to consider things that may or may not happen. Chances are, there's a good chance you're going to face something like it.
I mean, one of the things I like about it so much is that you get to give things a material foundation, factual foundations, but also move on from there. I really like it that you brought up the scalability side of things, because I really do like to emphasize that the kind of work that we're doing is within reach of all of us. We've all got minds. We're all capable of thinking about the future. The plausible thing is an important one as well, because, you know, all sorts of things are possible. You know, most of the time when we talk about scenarios, we're actually talking about what I think are called the predictive ones. So, you know, what are the range of the possible or likely states of affairs that might be coming along, and, you know, say, what would they be like in 2050 or something? And there are some things that are less likely, but are quite plausible. I mean, I'm not quite sure how likely a pandemic was. I don't really know the likelihoods on that sort of thing. Sort of risen up the ranks of the plausible, I would say, in the last few years, I think. That's the sort of thing that we would think about. Yeah, so just before I leave the scenarios, there's another stream of a way of thinking about scenarios, which someone called Adam Kahane developed. It comes from South Africa, where it was used for dealing with really intractable problems in South Africa, as you can imagine, what with apartheid, the ending of it. That's called transformative scenarios. And what it asks people to do is not so much think about what is likely or plausible. It's asking people to think about what they might want or just not want. What are four scenarios that we could possibly achieve that we want or just really want to avoid? So he uses, I mean, there are a whole lot of techniques involved in there to elicit information. Nick and I actually were just before we're talking about the work that anthropologists can do in this space, really interesting work from social research that can help elicit people's thoughts and engagements on this. The idea more with the transformative scenarios is that you get people collectively committed in a trust generating way to thinking about what might be the future that we want in a place, not just accommodating themselves to the one that seems plausible or likely. Do you see the difference there? It's a decision to make something a certain way rather than accommodate your actions to a state of affairs. Yeah, I do. I actually have a lot of admiration for the transformative scenarios work, partly because I think we tend to emphasize prediction and we need to think more, because it's another way to reduce uncertainty is to make a decision about how you want it to be and make it that way.
What you just talked about really made me reflect on a whole lot of different roles I've been in, corporate roles in my career, which often focus on, you know, what I've come to think about is the defense game. So, you know, you talk about the future we want, and so much of the corporate conversations are about the future we don't want. So, you know, if we can flip the conversation, and if you people are risk professionals who are listening in, or auditors, those sorts of people, how much time do you spend at an audit risk committee talking about the strengths of the organization and doubling down on the strengths of what you're trying to do? Like, really focusing on, as you said, the future that you want, you know, and reducing uncertainty gives more confidence in decision making, which, you know, you talked about. Do you want to perhaps just, you know, you want to narrow down a little bit to talk about sort of uncertainty and in the context of risk assessment? We talked about that.
Change always produces uncertainty, Jono. It's not just that the future is uncertain. That's mostly what we've been talking about, really. It's the decision to take steps to make things how you want them to be or pursue an objective for whatever reason. It produces uncertainty. And the thing is that you want to be able to manage that as much as you can as well. There are a couple of things that I have a couple of thoughts on that. One of them is a piece of work, a program of work by someone called Jane McGonigal in the US. She leads a research team there. And I'm just so interested, so impressed with the work they've done there. It's work on games, but I don't want that to make it sound like it's a trivial thing. There was one podcast I listened to, and again, that'll go in the show notes, where she talks about a game that she did with a number of people, I don't know, 10 or more years ago, where she asked participants to imagine what it would be like if they were in a pandemic, amazingly like COVID, okay, so respiratory illness, highly infectious, affecting the whole globe. She asked people to imagine vividly these circumstances, and it turns into an if-then thing. So if this is the case, just say, you know, you've got curfews, just say you have to wear a mask, and you've still got to live your life. What then? What would you do in these circumstances? And it was amazingly predictive of what we actually turned out to discover in real life, you know, about why people violated curfews, for instance, what their reasons were, how they, you know, the kind of civil unrest and discord that started to emerge and so on. I think that serious and interesting approach to games is a really interesting and effective way to discover some of the sources of uncertainty with life-changing events or change of any kind. They're a powerful social test, and they're really brilliant because what can happen, those things that might happen, they're usually a consequence of what people do. It's the behaviours and social stuff rather than the, you know, you can be really clever about designing rules or designing infrastructures and so on, but it's what people do, which is the really unpredictable stuff. And the games, the social testing that can be done in those games is a really, really fantastic way to discover something that you really can't find out any other way. Yeah, so I just really highly recommend that one, actually, and I would love to see more of that going on in the public sector. Another one which has come across my desk a bit more recently, which I really like as well, it's more a framing of what needs to be done, which is social R&D. You know, you hear climate scientists say, for instance, that the past is no longer a guide to the future when it comes to climate. And I actually really think that we need to adopt something like that for society. So the past, the way we've done things in the past, our social practices, our institutions, our regulatory frameworks and so on, just because we've done them all the way up like that up till now doesn't mean we should continue doing things that way. Maybe they're just not fit for purpose. They're maladaptive in the climate and environment that we're moving into. The problem with that is we don't always know what might go in there in their place, which is where the concept of social R&D is. And it's something where you need to engage with people in an equal way to design, co-design solutions. You know, again, on this one, I've got something in the show notes on that rather than spend our time talking more about that. But there's a couple of things there that I think are really promising, social R&D and the social testing that you can do through games, like we saw with the US. Finally, though, you know how much I love risk assessment. It's a real equalizer. It's something that everyone can do. And I know that people, this is something, you know, sustainability, becoming well adapted to the climate and environment that we have and will have in the future, it's something that people in the sector care about a lot. And there is a strong sense of, oh, what can I do? And the thing is that assessing risks is something that everyone can do. And just to pick up the scalability thing, it can be done at the most granular level and at the grandest scale. And when I'm talking about assessing risks, I'm talking about the cognitive work that you can do individually and together to identify a risk. Where are things uncertain? Analyze it, work together to analyze it, pick it apart, discover what are the things that you must make sure you keep going and what are the things you can afford to lose. So identify and analyze it. And then evaluate it, decide what it means to you, whether it makes a real, what sort of difference it makes to you. It's all stuff that can be done around the table, doesn't require any equipment, and we can all do it. If you were worried about what you and your organization can do to drive change, I would say if you could cultivate that skill, become an advocate for it, get really good at it in your team, in your branch, whatever unit of the organization you can be influential in, I think that would make a big difference.
Just like any discipline, I think, and it's like trying to cook a new recipe out of a book for your family or your friends on a Friday night and hoping it's going to go well by cooking it once. I mean, doing anything in life, and risk assessment's the same, I think, practice. So having the conversation, and time is a killer. Obviously, you know, getting the time to slow down and think about the future is hard, but you won't be successful if you don't practice the skill of doing what we've been talking about today. Thanks so much, Lynn. You and I, we collaborated on a piece of work to try and have this conversation about risk management and moving it a little bit away from being just a defense game to being a much more impactful conversation about the future we want. And we published a range of guides on my organization's website, State Governments Insurer, VMIA. So I encourage listeners to go and have a look at some of those, because we feel that we've put the conversation around risk into a more positive light, a different light. I think it's worth you going and having a read.
Yeah, we'll put those in the show notes. I do actually think we did some excellent work there. Worth a read. We cover a lot of those things that we talked about, like creating and protecting value, but also really basic sort of techniques and procedures and so on. But we also want to make sure it stays in that space where people are thinking about what's possible. They're using their thoughts and minds. They're deliberating together, working cooperatively, because this is what it comes down to. It's brains and it's time.
I hope that listeners haven't been put off thinking this is all too complex, because we don't think it is. And we also published a couple of guides, the first ones in Victoria for risk professionals around climate change. And the big message there is get on with it. It's not hard. It's not as hard as you think. Cognitive work can be difficult, but it's not some black box thing talking about climate change. A lot of it's very, very practical. And a lot of it's about dealing with what's actually happening now in Victoria and facing Victorians today. So it's not like we're having to imagine something that's the unimaginable, something we've not experienced. We are experiencing it now.
Great talking with you, Jono. Thanks very much.
You too.
I hope these podcasts change what you think and do when it comes to risk. We put it together based on what Lynn and I thought could be useful, based on our experience as practitioners. We'd both be interested to hear what your issues are when it comes to risks associated with a changing climate. What are the roadblocks, the mountains and tripwires out there that make it hard to act on climate change and adaptation risk? Contact details for us both are in the show notes. The podcast was developed by the Sustainability Community Practice at IPA Victoria, which is Victoria's peak public sector professional association, and aims to connect, empower, and celebrate Victoria's public sector. If you'd like to know more about this work, then search for sustainability on the IPA Victoria website, which is vic.ipaa.org.au. You can stay in touch with what we do by following us on LinkedIn at IPAA Victoria, or on Twitter at IPAAVIC. This program is produced on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Bunurong peoples of the Kulin Nations. I'm Jonathan Mason, and thanks for listening.